Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Sonny, how does the current revenue from e-visas and visas on arrival compare to the revenue generated in previous years, particularly before the introduction of the e-visa system?
So the 33 countries that were exempt from a visa over all these years never paid for anything. So if you look at everything we're making now, just the first month, the 25 million, and that's a month before the e-visa actually went into effect.
Exactly.
This is just online applications. We already, that's 25 million we never used to get. And the forecast is, if you look at the statistics of tourists coming from these countries, I think we should be aiming for at least 500 million Namibian dollars a year that we're going to get in more that we never used to get.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a big amount.
Indeed. Now, given that 15,506 travelers applied for e-visas in this short period, how does this number compare to the overall number of tourists visiting Namibia in recent years?
Yeah, look, it does come, it's a bit low, the numbers, because it's still new. Remember, we only started accepting tourists or people paying at the airport only started on the 1st of April, 2 days ago.
Yeah.
So all this money that so far has been generated is just online. But now everybody who comes in at the airport who hasn't paid online will also be paying from these countries. So in this month, you will see it go up to at least 50 or 80 million already.
Yeah.
Because now at the airport, you start collecting money. Online, you start collecting money. So it will grow a lot more from that. The estimate is almost 500,000 people come from these countries. So if you look at, if you see the same numbers, we are looking at a lot more, than 500 million a year. So it will grow.
Now, if Namibia had implemented the e-visa regime earlier, how might the country have seen a different pattern of tourism growth, particularly in relation to revenue generation and tourist numbers?
Yes and no. Everything happens at the right time because I feel technologically we were not there yet. Home Affairs was not equipped before the COVID era. When you see they implemented digital passport applications, ID applications, slowly they get into it. So now that they have done other things, it's the right time to go into e-visas and digitalization. So I think it's, we can't look back and see what if it could have happened, but seeing where the world is going, I think we should be making money from tourism. We should be making more money from tourism. The concern is, where is this money going? Because
that's
right
exactly
now,
what
all
I was
of,
about to ask you.
Okay. So yeah, so the thing is right now, all these funds go into treasury. They are not earmarked for immigration or tourism or anything. And I think that's another discussion. That's the next step now. How do we make sure that this money benefits tourism more than others? Because we are making money from tourists. And, you know, people will, tourists will start saying, yeah, but we're paying so much. Where's that money going? We don't see improvement. We you know, it's, Itosha doesn't have proper roads and all. So they might look at a better way to manage these funds, if I put it that way. Because tourism, a Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism, the budget they get, very little is allocated to actual tourism. And hopefully these funds help that.
And what specific areas would you say in tourism, of course, what are those specific areas that would you say the money should be directed towards?
Look, off the top of my head, roads, better information flow, accessibility to certain areas. Look at the heritage web, heritage sites. Our heritage, like Lake Oshikoto and other places where it's not easily accessible. There's not enough signage across the country for tourism sites. There are lots of things one can invest in. So ideally, if you have a committee looking at these funds and implementing it across different sections of tourism, we can really make a big impact.
Yeah. And what would you say also, how should Namibia prepare itself for more tourists coming into the country as we see now, obviously from these figures and the number of tourists coming in? How exactly should we prepare? I'm talking not just in terms of government themselves, but private sector as well.
I think we should work more together, look at how how different parts of Namibia that are underdeveloped can be further developed for tourism, how we can market Namibia better together online,
indeed,
other than the what NTB is doing. NTB usually goes to the events. That's one side of it. There's mm-hmm. still a lot more to be done digitally and working together, identify more newer tourism routes for people to take. We've got 100 museums in the country, but most tourists don't know about any museums.
Yeah.
We've got cultural groups in the country that tourists who self-drive don't even know when they're driving through a town mm-hmm. if there is a cultural group there or mm-hmm. a museum there.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to kind of consolidate all that information and make it easier accessible for the tourists.
Mm-hmm. I like that part where you say we should market more.
Yes, mm-hmm. definitely.
Yeah. Sunny, thank you so much for making time for us right here.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks.
Lisamar Dimbogoge, Pampepo, Zegora Sumbango, Dias Ep, Eziza Singo na Malisintakano, Gupanare, Taninaga, Gumape, Moktunda Gonkedi, Zoksimba no Buke, Domarsumo, Kumaoko, Uzagonkedi Zompe, Zoktura Marsumo, Musumbango, Dias Ep, Pampepo, Guanasumbango, Sospe, Sa Imba Ep, Zuvainyami, Mokaram Tetin Sume, Kusumbango, Si, Guana Karuhan Pepo, Kumarsumo, Pa Internet Meke, Yoge, Ruganesa, cell phone ding Kenya. Kara on Pokurukasi, Sumbangu Suspe, Aso Waswapukura, Sa Imba Ep, Aso Kret Sapo, Martimbo, Konosumo, Dokuri Siga Siga Dongerika, Pametu, Moktura Kumisrongo, Nokwane Sambud Zongwa, Yas Gospel. Martimbo Game, Novura Kurakena Muspangusi, Kunakaranye, the Elsin Eangano, the Osherero, Kumaimbiro, the Catholic. Simaneka Karunga, the Africans sing Froda here, and many more. Zene Munahara Kulisa Marsumo Geni, Musumbangu Saimba Epo, Mampepo, Guaninye go 081-2358-063.
Ni go email digital@omalaiti.com. I apologize for that. Let's now resume. The Deputy Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform, Ruth Maseka, recently conducted a regional familiarization tour in the Zambezi region to assess and address the ongoing locust outbreak. The Deputy Minister went with the Regional Governor, Lawrence Sampofu, in order to be briefed on what's happening off the ground. Sampofu provided a comprehensive overview of the situation in the region. Maseka met with the ministry's staff and farmers in the region and toured the local spraying team and several affected areas, including Old Maskontwane and the Linyati constituency. Now, to unpack the situation on the ground for us and the degree of the damage, we got into a conversation with Simon Nyipandura, the ministry spokesperson, to unpack the situation.
We are continuing with early morning scoop. We are looking at the recent familiarization visit by the Deputy Minister of Agriculture, Ruth Maseka, in Zambezi region, just to access the situation of the outbreak of locust in that region. So for us to unpack this, I got into conversation with the spokesperson of the ministry, Simon Nyipandura, just to engage us in the studio. Simon, good morning and welcome to Early Morning Scoop.
Yeah, very good morning, and how are you?
Yes, I'm doing well. Let us look at what have happened. Let us look at the criticality of the situation. When we look at the familiarization visit by the Deputy Minister, what are some of the critical situation that you can indicate, and what are some of the crops that were affected, or maybe the affected field? What are the numbers of affected fields in that area?
Okay, thank you very much for the question. Yes, the ministry has been getting reports of the locust outbreak, which is taking place in Zambezi region.
The
infestation or the attack is in the following it is recorded in the following regions. I mean, following areas.
Yeah.
Which is Sachona, Lubuta, Singalamwe, Omega, Chinchimani, Kanono, Batabaja, Muyako, Ngala, Mahundu, and Seke.
Mm-hmm.
So the Deputy Minister undertook a trip to Zambezi region, which started on the 4th
yeah.
of April.
Yeah.
Just recently arrived myself with a situation staffed by cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
So we visited the following region, I mean the following areas in Linyati, Masokotwani, and Old Masokotwani,
mm-hmm.
Where our teams are busy spraying. They took us to the fields that have been infested.
Yeah.
Where we have seen certain damage.
Mm-hmm.
Upon the inspection and upon scouting, we also have seen how bad the situation is.
Yeah.
But we are also confident to report back to the public that it is also under control.
Mm-hmm.
It is manageable. The ministry is having staff that's in the field that is doing the scouting, that's doing the spraying.
Yeah.
And also busy with awareness campaign, especially for the farmers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Ngipandula, let us look at the measures. Maybe what are the immediate measures in place put by the Minister of Agriculture in order to address this situation?
Okay, this infestation is not new to the region.
Yeah.
Must start there. Number one, the farmers are starting also to do controlling measures by by creating barriers. By creating barriers and using certain crops now to at the beginning of their field,
mm-hmm.
Such as crop which is called crop diversification.
Yeah.
Where they put crops such as sorghum millet.
Yeah.
Millet cell millet, which is less attacked by the locals because of its quality,
mm-hmm.
or characteristics. So, mm-hmm. That is one of the things that the farmers in the region have done. Then number two is the ministry is busy scouting areas. So what we do is we scout, we check where the movement of the locals, where they are nesting. And those are the areas that we spray. We take the fields if they are close to harvest, especially.
Mm-hmm.
We are noticing that the cropping season is coming to an end, and farmers are about to harvest their crop.
Mm-hmm.
So in that instance, we advise farmers when the crops are about to dry out,
yeah.
and they're ready for harvest, that we do not spray. Because of the danger that comes with the use of pesticide, you spray today and they harvest tomorrow. And then people infect, eat, and then it creates a danger.
Mm-hmm.
So when the crop is getting dry, it's less attacked by the locust because it's actually looking for moist for leaves that are moist, mm-hmm. or tender.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so that is number two. So the other third thing is we are spraying. Our teams are on the ground spraying areas which still have fresh crops, which are a bit far from harvesting.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, we are busy also doing awareness campaign, which is the most important one, especially by telling them that you cannot, once we spray, our teams spray close to your field or in your field,
yeah.
you cannot access your field for the next 3 weeks. Which is 21 days,
uh-huh.
Because of the precautionary measures that have to be taken and the dangers of the pesticide.
Yes, Simon, let us look at the readiness of the ministry in case this outbreak, go out of control or go beyond Zambezi region. How ready is the ministry to respond into the situation?
Okay, number one, as I said, this infestation or the attack is not new to us.
Yeah.
So what we have done over the years is we have trained staff in all 10 cropping regions.
Yeah.
We've got also the military personnel staff that are trained in the previous attacks.
Yeah.
We also got the National Youth Service staff that do come in once the situation is really out of hand and the ministry cannot control on their own.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the equipment, which is now in all the 10 crop growing regions,
yeah.
Ready for any infestation. So we've also got pesticides in our various satellite offices and also in the region. which also the part of the equipment also comes with protective clothing for the spraying team.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so the ministry is always ready.
Uh-huh.
In case of such infestation, and of course they are always budgetary provisions in case of DSA, which is now subsistence allowance for the staff when they're in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got camping gear or camping material for our staff to be ready to be placed at any place where the infestation and controlling is taking place.
Mm-hmm.
In the vicinity of our agricultural farmers area.
Okay, now let us look at the damage and also those who crops are damaged, because nobody invited locusts to come and damage the crops. How is the measures in place? Are the farmers whose crops are damaged by the locusts going to be compensated?
Unfortunately, the ministry does not have the mandate for compensation.
Yeah.
But what the government has done is just through its existing structures of drought relief, where we urge our farmers to register with their various regional constituency councils or regional offices, or those that are badly affected, so they can benefit from the drought relief that comes from the office of the Prime Minister.
Okay, Simon, let us look at the last question. Looking at now the budget allocation, is the Ministry of Agriculture always having, emergency fund for this situation, or they still have to go back to the office of the Prime Minister to seek for support?
No, we have budgeted for all emergencies. As this pest infestation or plant diseases can come at any time, as we've written in our press releases that these are transboundary diseases. It can come from any of the neighboring country.
Yeah.
So without any alert. So what we do, we have money set aside. And as I've mentioned, we have equipment. We have staff that are trained and ready to react to all these situations, whether it's locust infestation, whether it's plant-related diseases that might break out, whether it's fall armyworms, as we've been doing in the past few months also. So it's not just the money that we put aside, but it's also equipment and the personnel that we have that is ready at all times to react.
Yes, thank you very much, Simon Hibandura, for joining us this morning.
All right, it's a pleasure.
Well,
let's now pause here for a commercial break, but we'll be back shortly with more news.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
And now we continue in regards to flood and water situation in Oshana region. Various governors in Umsati and Oshana region have been warning residents about the heavy rain on the region and the possibility of flood. Now, to understand the situation, our reporter have visited some villages in Oshana to get a picture on the ground. The heavy rain has cut off some villages from accessing roads, and alternative transportation has to be adopted. Kau Kamasheshe and nearby villages have been overflowing and caused the villages to be cut off from the main transport system and make it difficult for transportation and movement of people and animals. Now, looking at the situation, we got in contact with our colleague Loisa Shimi to give us an update of the water situation and how they are affecting the people.
Yes, we are continuing with Early Morning Scoop. It was indicated that areas of Shakati West, Kaukamasheshe, in Oshana region, the water is still continue overflowing, and which also cut some of the villagers from the main transportation system and also make it difficult for the movement of people and also animals. In order for us to unpack this, we got into conversation with our colleague Loisa Shimi just to engage us in the studio and on the situation on the ground and what are some of the main challenges on the ground regarding running of water in that area. Good morning, Loisa Shimi, and welcome to Early Morning Scoop.
Good morning, David, and how are you?
I'm doing very well. Let us look at the flowing of water. How critical is the situation in Oshakati Western Oshana region, particularly in terms of movement of people, animals, and also main transportation system?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for that question, David. Although I don't know even what to say or where to start, honestly, because, I mean, seeing the water over, like it's all over, it's overflowing, like it's over flooded everywhere you are going.
Okay.
Or where you are heading to. I mean, you know, the situation out there, David, no?
Yeah.
I mean, asking also people that are surrounding the people in the village, I say that, no, that at all, that is just the rainy water.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at some parts you could see that like the water is also moving, so that means that maybe it's also flood or something.
Yeah.
But then the fact that also in some areas there's also fish, and that means also that maybe it could be also the flooding water.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in terms of now, how is the situation also that side?
Yeah.
It's so not good because I mean, I had a funeral actually.
Yeah.
But then, like, going to where the funeral is happening.
Yeah.
It's just so not easy.
Yeah.
Because I mean, you're not going to go in that water. You cannot pass through that water. Like, I mean, if someone would tell you that no, if you go in that water, honestly, like, it will reach. Maybe you might even be drowned because it's high. Like.
It's scary.
Like it's everywhere. Like there's no way you will go, and then you will maybe reach where there's no water. Like it's just water. Whatever you can see is just water, and you cannot go.
Uh-huh.
And now there's a place. I mean, from Oshakati you can just go, and then there's a gravel road where you can pass. But then even that gravel road, it's now broken and also overflowing because you know they are. I mean, I think that time maybe when they maybe construct that gravel road, maybe they did not check very properly, or maybe it was not even that flowing or something.
Yeah.
Because I mean, where there were maybe supposed to be a bridge or something.
Yeah.
I mean, there, the water have to make a way to go the other side. That's where, like, wherever you are going, honestly, it's just like that. Like, you're just in the water.
Okay, Lisa, while we are there, what kind of transportation system are you using, or what kind of transport are you using to reach main facilities such as church, clinics, and maybe nearby shops or stores?
All right. I mean, that's a great question that I even asked my aunties that are there to ask. How do you guys get to Oshakati? Because I mean, in the the area in Okawa Komashisha, it's a very longer distance, man.
Uh-huh.
You cannot go. It's a place where you cannot go with you walking to Oshakati. You cannot go like that. You can only go with a car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then now going there with a car, and it's like this is a situation right now. You might not able to go to a place where because you're not going to a place where you can able to get a cab.
Yeah.
Not a cab, but then just at the just a 4x4 because like that time you used 4x4 or bigger cars, not small cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now going to now a way where you can get that is not gonna be easy because I mean it's raining almost every day.
Okay.
I'm glad that today is not even raining and it's choking.
Yeah.
So now going there now, you cannot able to go there because like from your house it's already overflowing. You cannot get there. So you can only use a donkey cart where, I mean, it's like a trailer connected with a tractor.
Okay, okay.
So now, in that tractor, you have to pay, like they charge $100 per pick.
Okay,
like,
okay.
You like wherever you're going, because you need to go to maybe it's like a cooker shop where there are sometimes cars that can go. Not necessarily even Oshakati because like you cannot go alone because I mean a car can start anywhere because honestly this water, the water level, David, if I can explain to you, right?
Yeah.
I don't know, but then
okay,
because you cannot able just to go like that. So cars right now they are packed. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Even I asked even my uncles that like you guys should don't go to Oshakati because he has a car. But he said no. I think we were just waiting for August. Then maybe the maybe that time.
Yeah.
it will be a better situation because right now you cannot risk it. And then they said, no, and if the car itself, you cannot just be putting your car like that in the water like that because if you also do a trouble, it can get broken anytime, and then that will also cost you a lot of money to fix it yourself. So now this time, this time the cars are just parked. And now, but then there are also those people that are risking, not just risking, but then that you have just nowhere to rather keep your car there. Like, I mean, you can use this trailer, and then if you go to a cooker shop where you can now drive your car. But then if your car have been already in the house, you're not able to do that because, like, you cannot drive in the water. This is the water where, you know that the tractor wheels.
Yeah, I know.
They are inside. Like, if you could see the tractors. I mean, I feel like my weight is already, there.
Yes.
That's off the whole wheel.
Yes.
So you cannot.
Yes, let's say while we are there, let us look at leadership in that situation. You know, critical situation like that, they need the leadership. How is the communication from either traditional leaders, constituency councillors, or even just the community leaders? What are their advice? What are they saying to the public and also to the community regarding the water situation?
Okay, that one maybe I did not really ask that because, I mean, you know, even the meeting does not even happen now.
Okay.
And I got even communication with the pastor.
Yeah.
And so to ask, like, okay, do you guys maybe get, like, do people come to church as normal?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like yesterday, it was a burial. And then so we went to church and I got in connection with the pastor. And they said, look, this time, some people also just do some services near some certain centers where you can able to go and just make a little of a service, like a Sunday service.
Okay.
And that's all they can do right now. Otherwise, going to church. Like, we went to church on yesterday.
Yeah.
But we did not, we use a tractor only from home until the cooker shop. From the cooker shop, we use cars.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't know how many times, because we have one with a 4x4 that can also pull us out if we get stuck, and we got stuck. I don't know how many times. Like, it's just not easy. You could not have your small car thing that you get there, or you just get in the car. Like, you cannot. It's just not easy, David. And with the food, right, because obviously you can ask, like, how do these people survive? If you need cooking oil, if you need salt, if you need relish, if you need all that, how do you get to Oshakati then?
Yeah.
Because obviously, even if you go into to Oshakati, right now, the problem even also to get a cab to go to Oshakati, but then honestly, I cannot. Like, I cannot. First of all, you need to get a trailer or a tractor, and then you need to pay that $100. But what if you pay your $100 and you go to that cooker shop and no any car that's going to Oshakati? Like, it's just so hectic. And again, that you have to pay that $100 to come back home, and then maybe wait for the next thing to get a car that's going to Oshakati. Like, you need to communicate first, like, is there a car there going to Oshakati? Because it's not that easy. So now with the food, David, is that with the food, so they said that, I mean, they knew already that the rain was not that good, and then they thought, like, I mean, they don't think, I mean, they knew already that maybe the situation could be like that, So what they did that January and also December, they bought, like, you need the cooking oil, you need to buy maybe a 5 or a 10 kg just to have it, or I mean, millions, just to have it already in the house.
Yeah.
And you need to buy also just enough salt. You need to buy that because for the relish right now, it's not really a problem because, like, there's beans in the house. Maize, there's all that in the house. So it's not really a worrisome situation. Plus also the fish out there, like, people are not talking to.
So you are getting, from the situation, you're also getting advantage from the situation also.
You are also getting that advantage also, because otherwise, if there was no fish, there was no anything, I don't know how they will survive this time. Because, but then they know the situation already.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could also pay that $100 to get to a cooker shop. But cooker shop also, things are super expensive, David, because they are in demand.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that, I mean, I'm the only one selling cooking oil there.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe two people. or like you cannot make things cheaper there because you know one tall knot.
Yeah, you have to buy
it. You can just buy the thing, even if it's $100, you can just buy because I mean, otherwise,
you will not survive.
I don't know how you will risk it to get to a Oshakati then.
Louise Ashimi, thank you very much for that update and wish you safe.
All right, thank you so much, David. No, we'll be safe.
All right,
the
cool.
The truck is on our side.
All right, all right.
That is the water situation at Kau Kamasheshe in Oshana region and how it has affected the mobility and economic situation of the people and the danger of water on human lives and infrastructure. Lisa also spoke to how the residents have to improvise on their mode of transportation, which is being used, and the increase in transportation fees due to the high demand. Now, if you just joined us, you are listening to Early Morning Scoop, your morning dose of economic updates to start your day and make rational economic decisions. They say goods do not move from the warehouse by themselves, but because of the market information that is shared among economic agents, enabling transactions to take place. Now, thus, every morning we bring economic policy and industrial updates. As we continue to bring updates on the tabled national budget, we have now moved to the private sector to get their views on the budget. Thus, our next item is the importance of the national budget on the local economy, coming out right up after the commercial break.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Now, for this financial year of 2025-2026, the government will plan to procure between 40 billion Namibian dollars to 60.8 billion Namibian dollars worth of goods and services under the operational and capital budget. The Namibian local businesses are hoping to partake in the government procurement process in order to keep the tax money or the dollars circling in the economy. However, there are different views from members of business communities and analysts on procurement and how money should be utilized. We got into a conversation with entrepreneur Paratus Nepolo to engage us on this.
Yes, we are continuing with Early Morning Scoop. We are looking at business development and we are also looking at potential development, particularly in the sector of procurement. It was indicated that for this financial year, 2025-2026, the government will procure 60.8 billion worth of goods and service under the operational and capital budget. And there are a lot of questions, particularly when it's coming to, you know, business leaders and also local entrepreneurs who can also venture into this area or can take advantage of this this investment. To unpack this in the morning, I got into conversation with Mr. Paratus Nepolo. He's a business leader, one of the business leaders in Namibia, and I'm going to engage him regarding this procurement area. Mr. Paratus Nepolo, good morning and welcome to Early Morning Scoop.
Yes, good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Yes, let us look at procurement. What do you think must be done to ensure that this money is spent on the local economy by both government and also entrepreneurs, particularly when it's coming to procurement of goods and services?
The 6 billion,
yeah.
It's a very exciting news,
yeah.
Good number. And to me, as an experienced business leader and also entrepreneur,
yeah.
That money is well spent. It's quite enough to sustain the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't spend it wisely,
yeah.
it can also be a problem, and it will also leave people accused of eating up that money.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, money are not being eaten up.
Yeah.
In most cases, money is not just well spent.
Uh-huh.
Yes, because, I mean, look, if you said the money has been eaten up and the money was spent in the economy,
yeah,
money was supposed to circulate, even though it's not with that sector,
uh-huh.
It will end up on the other sector.
Uh-huh.
But if money is not well spent, that money cannot be felt. And in most cases, the money disappears. in the country economy, because if the money is not well spent, you end up spending money in most cases to support foreign economies,
mm-hmm.
by procuring most of your goods from internationally. That way that money, you wouldn't feel it in the economy because you did not spend it at the right, you know, in the right sectors.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to say simply is the 6 billion is quite enough if we spend it locally.
Okay, Mr. Nepolo, looking at the 60 billion on procurement, do you think local companies or local, you know, businesses have the capacity to meet government consumption need for the year? Because you know, a lot of business individuals, they start also giving their views to say we are underlooked when international companies are given, you know, these tenders and here and there. But in your views and through your experience, do you think local companies have capacity to support or to give what is needed by the government?
The question of capacity is not really an issue.
Mm.
However, we need to take cognizance of the fact that we give too much freedom to foreign companies to do business with government.
Mm-hmm.
There must be a limit. Like if you are constructing a school,
yeah.
If you are constructing a school, and that school you give it to a foreign company, and you allow that foreign company actually to import materials from their countries, it will not go to help a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It will not go to help a lot because now by allowing that company to import the materials and the goods from their country, in this case I'm now referring to South Africa or China,
yeah.
Because those are our biggest partners in development.
Yeah, yeah.
So we must not allow them to import goods or materials for the projects that are happening in Namibia,
mm-hmm.
and also to import skill that we already have local. I can guarantee you our TVET education have done pretty well over the years. Therefore we really don't need to import skill. In most skills that we need to utilize to execute this project successfully,
mm-hmm.
we already have them in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, you know, you find a contractor,
yeah.
That brings their own trucks, their own drivers, and also sometimes their own handymen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those skills, if we import them,
yeah.
that means we're actually exporting our money out of our economy
to the foreign country. Yeah,
it is. Mm-hmm. So what I'm advising is that we really must try to avoid by all means to export.
Yeah,
the skill. I mean, to import the skill, also to import most of the materials. The materials must be imported. Must really be the materials that are not local, that we cannot really find locally in the local suppliers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Nepolo, you are in refrigeration and cooling sector. Do you think the Ministry of Works could channel part of its budget to remove toxic cooling gases within the public sector?
You know, our sector, the cooling sector, is one of the biggest sectors that could actually now, as you speak, bring much cash flow in the economy.
Yeah.
Because there are already regulation, and maybe it's already a signatory to some agreement like Montreal Protocol Agreement and also Kigali Amendment that says by 2029 we may not have equipment that contain R22 gas. But already equipment, when I refer to equipment, refrigerating equipment, I refer to freezer room, cold rooms, motorists, and also air conditions.
Mm-hmm,
but 70% of the air conditions
are still having R22.
Mm-hmm.
But the regulations, I mean, the agreements are already saying if Namibia don't achieve that, we're going to be punished as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And already, I'm happy that the regulator, Minister of Industrialization and Trade, by then, now which we follow now under Minister of Mines and Trade, I mean, Mines and Industry, we have potential now to really create more employment, especially also giving more internship by the students or trainees that are studying refrigeration air condition, because the directive is already given by the ministry that now, as we speak, all the equipment that are in Namibia must be upgraded with ozone-friendly gases or ozone-friendly refrigerant, which is R147, and also to replace them, if possible, with the natural gases like R600, R290.
Yeah.
So we have potential to create that 60 billion portion of it could come to the sector so that we upgrade those equipment, because that's an agreement that's already international signed and we cannot run away from it. But if that money, some of that budget channel to the sector, we have potential then to create more employment and also to do the right thing so that we really meet the government halfway by complying with the international standard and also by creating employment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, maybe the last question is the message that you have to fellow entrepreneurs, particularly those who get, you know, government work and they don't deliver. What message do you have to them?
You know, I said an entrepreneur does not really abandon the project. A entrepreneur abandons the project. Why am I saying that?
Yeah.
Entrepreneur understand the importance of the brand and also the reputation of their businesses.
Yeah.
Because entrepreneur want to have a relationship with their clients.
Mm-hmm,
but entrepreneur, in most cases, they tender, they make money, and then they go and flush, and they go invest elsewhere.
Yeah.
They are not full-time. In most cases, they are not full-time business people.
Yeah.
Therefore, in most cases, once they are awarded a tender, even though they use the right qualification to be awarded those tender, if they get the tender, they end up paying or appointing less experienced contractors or less experienced artisans.
Then the question is, what message do you have to them?
Well, the question is, the message I have to them is, once they have the tender, they must start it up with repeatable businesses, depending on the sector, so that when they pick up with the repeatable businesses, or depending on the sector, that means they will deliver quality.
Yeah.
Once they deliver quality, will not only going to assist the government to attain its goal, but it's also going to assist them to have a trusted brand.
Mm-hmm,
so that
mm-hmm.
when the government have a next project, they can always think of them because they have done a quality job. So what I'm encouraging here is between entrepreneurs and the tenderpreneurs to have a serious collaboration. Because in most cases, tenderpreneurs know how to tender. They know the procedures. They know. But entrepreneurs, sometimes when they don't get work, that synergy is much necessary so that they combine that two aspects of them getting the tenderpreneur getting the work and the entrepreneurs delivering the quality service.
Yes, Mr. Paratus Nepolo, thank you very much for joining us this morning and thank you for your input.
Thank you very much for Eagle FM for continuing really disseminating the information that are relevant to the development of our mighty Namibia.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, Paratus Nepolo spoke on the way the government should prioritize promotion of local economic development through prioritizing capable local businesses. He said there's a need for communication and cooperation between the entrepreneurs and contractors in order for them to share capital and expertise. Now, still with the national budget, given the catalytic ability of government expenditure, if it gets to be spent in the local economy through local sourcing, it has been noted that many local companies struggle with project or tender financing. the questions of concern, how can invoice or tender financing be the solution in unlocking or enhancing local participation in public procurement, now to ensure the local budget is spent at home? Well, to unpack this, we got into a conversation with Venduka Kauyahar, the business analyst at Bellatrix SME Finance.
Yes, we are continuing with Early Morning Scoop. We are looking at finance, we are looking at procurement and also tendering. It was indicated that 60.8 billion, which is a quite catalytic, if it get to be spent in local economy through local sourcing, it's going to be an improvement in the Namibian economy. However, it has been noted that many local companies struggle with project tender financing. To engage us on this, I got into contact with an SME analyst at Bellatrix SME Finance, who is Vekunda Kakuyaha, just to engage us on the studio and give us an overview, particularly on the topic of, tender financing. Vekunda, good morning and welcome to Early Morning Scoop.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Yes, let us look at tender financing. What is your view on this concept of tender financing, particularly when we are looking at supporting local businesses when it's coming to the process of procurement?
Yeah, I think the biggest hurdle is execution for SMEs.
Yeah,
because a lot of entities, when you're looking, and this is going away from the government entities, right? Because there's a procurement act that actually allows the SMEs to be prioritized, especially local SMEs to be prioritized in regards to the procurement of items.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, even when you're looking at private companies and where they procure their services and goods from, there's always a risk or a perception that SMEs are not capable of executing on contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then from a financier's perspective, we sit down and we look at the applications that we receive to say that most of these guys who have this tender contracts usually already have a supplier.
Yeah.
Or they have been sourcing for suppliers for their items.
Yeah.
They have the contract.
Yeah.
And the main thing then is financing that they are struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
Financing to comfortable financing that isn't too expensive.
Yeah.
To allow them to procure the items. And sometimes also, even when you're going to your supplier and you're going to make a payment arrangement with your supplier, for instance, you want to have that guarantee that you actually do have the financing available.
Yeah.
And it isn't, so even if you agree to a deposit payment for them to manufacture the goods or deliver the goods,
yeah,
for the remaining payment to happen afterwards, after delivery, which is supposed to be your common practice.
Yeah.
Within any logistics or supply chain, you are always then left with the supplier then not being comfortable with the SME,
yeah,
because they then have the perception that the SME doesn't have funds available,
yeah,
that they already have secured, and perhaps they want to deliver, and then after they've delivered, receive payment to then be able to pay the supplier. So when you look at that and you understand that once you actually come in as a financial institution to guarantee access to finance to the SME,
yeah,
it then becomes easier for them to negotiate with their suppliers for favorable terms.
Yeah.
It becomes easier for them to then also include things like insurance, in transit insurance and so forth, to make sure that they don't lose out if something is to go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then also when they have the financing available, it's now also easier for them to then go back to their suppliers and scrutinize the suppliers that they have, to find out, are they actually getting the terms that they should be getting that are market related? Is the supplier reputable and so forth? But you can only do those things once you have gotten the first hurdle out of the way, which is accessing capital.
Mm-hmm.
So from our perspective as financiers, we look at the contract and the purchase order that the client has,
yeah,
as an asset. We look at it as a receivable,
yeah,
which then means that if that particular SME delivers,
yeah,
there's a payment due to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then on our job then becomes to ensure delivery, to ensure that if any payments are made by us, that client is actually going to deliver what is being ordered from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Vekunda, maybe just to emphasize on ensuring that, when it's coming to tender financing, how can invoice or tender financing be the solution to unlocking or maybe to say enhancing local participation in public procurement?
When you're looking at invoice discounting, we also have understood that once you actually look at SMEs that are in the tendering space, they usually have multiple purchase orders.
Mm-hmm.
And they have multiple orders running. Some of them they have already delivered. Some of them they are waiting for payments on, while at the same time trying to service a new purchase order that they have. And with invoice discounting, you then also understand that even if you just look at the invoicing process alone, some entities, for instance, have 30 days or 60 days payment terms and so forth. And if you have a purchase order immediately that you need to deliver on, but you already have an invoice submitted and you don't want to wait the 30, 60 days, that time taken for you to receive your payment is also very, very crucial and critical. And hence why it created an opportunity for us to then be able to assist SMEs where we can then pay them up to 90% of the invoice value upfront. Once we have confirmed invoice and we've confirmed delivery with the off-taker, we can then give them up to 90% of the invoice value upfront. And then we are then the ones who are waiting for the entity to pay us out at the end. That's basically how we look at it with the invoice discounting. But the whole idea around it is to say you have money due to you. You have a particular need right now. And we are just giving you access to that money. We're just giving access to that financing that is already due to your company because you've already delivered a service or goods.
Finally, let us look at maybe what is your advice either to SMEs or maybe local businesses, particularly those who are in tendering, businesses, but they fail to submit the necessary needs or there are some challenges on the way. What is your advice to them? Maybe what do you see as the main blockage to local businesses, whether they have money or don't have money in accessing government tenders?
The main one is perception. It's the risk perception around it, right? From this, and again, look, you have three guys within that key chain. You have the government who's given the tender. You have the SME who has to deliver. You have the SME supplier. Then from the SME, they have a financier involved who's financing them, right? So you have now four people involved in that key chain. And the one entity that is linking all of them together is the actual SME themselves. And the biggest problem when it comes to them being able to participate is then the perception of risk to them. So the perception of risk from the government side in regards to we've given this guy the tender, is actually going to deliver. It's a critical item. They said they can do it in 3 weeks. Will they actually be able to do it in 3 weeks? Which then to the advice to the SMEs is, on top of trying to win the tender and give as much favorable terms as possible, you also need to do your research on what it is that you're providing. Where are you getting it from? How long will it take? If you are ordering your goods from China, for instance, you're looking at almost 60 days of shipment time. Are you actually communicating with the off-taker, giving them an appropriate expectation of delivery based on where you are going to get your goods? So, for instance, you use a supplier from South Africa. You know that they will take 3 weeks for the goods to arrive. When you get the tender, you then procure the items from China. So that's now another 60 days. But your off-taker, the government, is expecting those goods in 3 weeks. So once the 3 weeks are gone, they're putting pressure on you and they're already starting to consider canceling the tender. So is that allowing you, giving them the managing that expectation, if I'm making sense? Secondly, and then again, from the supplier's perspective, is then if I have to manufacture these goods for you, for your tender that you have, what certainty do I have that once I actually start manufacturing, you're going to come pay? And once I'm finished with these goods, you're actually going to take them on and you're not going to cancel the order. So you see that perception of risk from the supplier that they have of the SME. And then from a financier's perspective, there's the perception of risk again to say, we've already financed your tender. If something goes wrong, are you going to call me as an analyst? Are you going to send me a text? Are you going to call me to explain what's going on? The goods have been stopped at the border. It's another 2-3 days. Are you going to actually give me a call and give me an update, or are you going to wait for me to to look for
to
you,
look for you. Yes.
To be able to give me that update. So indeed, all of these different things, basically, and building those relationships with the government, with your, not necessarily the government itself, but even the end user. Because in the government, there's the person who's going to sit with the goods. So if you're ordering laptops, for instance, for any government entity, mm-hmm, there's the IT department who are going to use those goods. Are you garnering and are you forming relationships with them? Are you forming relationships with your financiers? Are you forming relationships with your suppliers? Because at the end of the day, all of that is also almost a game of relationship that you're playing, mm-hmm, where you then work on your relationship to then be able to give a satisfactory service delivery.
Yes, Vekunda Kakuyaha, thank you very much for joining us this morning, and thank you for your analysis.
Okay, no, not a problem at all.
Thank you.
There you have it, the importance of accessing finance for local businesses to strengthen their binding chances, and for SMEs to make sure that they have put their finance in order to build confidence from financiers going forward. Now, that said, a short commercial break and we'll be back with yet more news.
Don't be a silent listener. You can air your opinions, ask questions, and converse with us in studio on 083-288-401.
Welcome back. Now we're talking about U.S. tariffs on Namibia. It is noted that the U.S. government has imposed a 21% tariffs on the African countries, which include Namibia. This have created challenges when it comes to global trade and make it difficult for developing countries to partake in international trade. The executive director in the Ministry of International Relations and Trade, Ambassador Nande, stated this.
The government of the Republic of Namibia has taken note of the U.S. government's recent reciprocal tariff imposed on African countries, which includes 21% tariffs on Namibia. The move by the U.S. administration has created turbulence in global trade, which undermines the commitment under AGOA, a non-reciprocal agreement designed to support developing countries and least developed countries in Africa by leveraging preferential access to U.S. markets. Unfortunately, this measure could result in unfair market conditions for Namibian products to compete fairly within the U.S. market. In response to the 21% tariff imposed on Namibian exports to the United States, it is important to clarify that these duties are not based on the most favored nation principle, but on the U.S. trade deficit, with each country divided by the total value of imports from nations trading with the United States. Consequently, the implementation of reciprocal tariffs by the United States of America is outlined in the April 2, 2025 White House settlement could potentially supersede existing trade agreements, including the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, and significantly impact trade flows. While Namibia's 42% tariff on the U.S. may be a contributing factor, it is important to note that not all goods from the United States of America into Namibia attract customs duties as per the SACU tariff structure. In terms of the SACU agreement, the Council shall, on the recommendation of the Tariff Board, approve customs duties to be applied to goods imported into the common customs area from outside that area. Therefore, this action requires a balanced approach from SACU member states, including Namibia, to find a workable solution based on reciprocity. In terms of mitigating the impacts of the tariffs imposed, stakeholders' engagement will be imperative to gauge and establish the extent of the effects imposed by the U.S. In addition, the ministry would explore several strategies to mitigate the impacts of the 21% tariffs imposed by the United States, which the ministry cannot reveal at this point in time. It is also worth noting that the imposition of tariffs could lead to decreased competitiveness of Namibian beef and fish exports to the United States market, potentially reducing sales volumes and demand for Namibian products due to price increases attributed to the tariff. Overall, the tariffs could disrupt established supply chains and negatively affect Namibia's export earnings, impacting broader preferential stability for Namibian products under the General System of Preferences regime. The Government of the Republic of Namibia, through the Ministry of International Relations and Cooperation, will remain vigilant in monitoring the evolving dynamics of the America First policy on trade, as well as its implications for non-reciprocal trade agreements.
Executive Director Penda Nanda has indicated that the move by U.S. administration undermine Angoa agreement and non-reciprocal agreement unfair market competition to Namibia. He stated that this duties are not based on the most favored nation principle. He mentioned that SACU countries must find a balanced approach to trade, and the ministry will impose several strategies to look at the imposition of tariffs. Now, still on the same topic, on the imposition of 21% tariffs to Namibia and other African countries, we got into a conversation with economist Robert Simon, who provided analysis on the principles of most favored nation principles and what Namibia can do in order to react to such tariff imposition on its trade.
Yes, we are continuing with Early Morning Scope. We are looking at international trade, and we are also looking at some of the international decisions which were taken. We are looking at the U.S. government, which imposed, 21% tariff to African countries, particularly in terms of trade. However, for us to unpack this, we got into the conversation with Robert Simon, who is an economist and is going to unpack particularly on this case. Robert Simon, good morning and welcome to Early Morning Scoop.
Hi, good morning and thank you for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. Yeah, let us look at decision by the United States of America. It has been noted that, the U.S. 21% tariff has been determined using, unorthodox method that are not, based on MFN, that is most favored nation principle. To you, can you please elaborate for us what does this mean and how biased it could be?
All right, and thank you once again for having me. It's a very very confusing topic,
yeah.
Very sensitive for some countries.
Yeah.
But first of all, maybe we should start by understanding what is a tariff.
Okay.
It is basically a tax on an imported good.
Yeah.
That is coming into a domestic market, and sometimes you will find also some export tariffs, which is also just a tax on an exported goods.
Mm-hmm.
I should agree with you when you said the 21%, which is imposed on Namibia specifically.
Yeah.
And of course, many other African countries, I think around 20 countries or so.
Yeah.
Each country were given their own tariffs based on their own situation. And as we understand these, the methodology which was utilized to arrive at that particular tariff is very much outside the World Trade Organization principle.
Yeah.
Remember that the both Namibia and the United States of America are member states, a party to a world trading system, which is administered by the World Trade Organization.
Mm.
Under the legal instruments administered by that WTO institution, there are various principles that needs to be observed by, member states.
Yeah.
And one of them you have just mentioned, which is the most favored nation. And that principle really means that countries will not act in such manner that they will discriminate one country over the other one, using tariffs, for instance. So that basically means if the United States is going to offer a lower tariff to a United Kingdom, for argument's sake, that same rate of tariff should also be extended to Namibia, because we are all in under that, or operating under the World Trade Organization structures. So unless otherwise, a country is only allowed to deviate from this principle only and only if there is a trade agreement between, say, the United States and the United Kingdom. In such manner, they are allowed to deviate from the MFN principle. One of the other principles that, in my mind, is violated by this tariff imposing is the national treatment of the like product. So and that basically means to treat a foreign and domestic goods equally after they have entered the same market. And in this particular conversation, we're talking about the American market. The third one is about transparency, the commitment to reduce tariffs, fair competition, as well as the special and differential treatment for developing countries, of which Namibia is one. All these principles are really violated by the USA government when they imposed the tariffs. However, I think there is still more many opportunities that we should, as well as Namibia, we should be looking at, because the whole supply chain has been disrupted, and you know, the investment is going to shift from one country to another country, where you know the business persons are looking for better deals in order to enter the US market.
And now that has brought us to the conclusion of today's edition of Early Morning Scoop. To stay tuned for Unpacking the Day with Michael Chiavelli, also make sure that you catch up on the headlines in today's newspaper, that is The Villager ePaper. Now from Indafa Happy Juju, it is goodbye and have yourself a wonderful day.